Right, well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Christopher Hill. I'm from the Department of International Relations here at LSE. It's my pleasure and honour to be able to introduce this second lecture by Fred Halliday in the World at 2000 series, which, as you know, is part of the Spanning the Centuries series of lectures being put on by LSE in this academic year, kindly sponsored by the publisher Macmillan and by the Foreign Policy Centre down the road. I'll get the administration out of the way first by saying that Macmillan are pleased to announce that you get a 20% discount on their books outside after this event, and that the Fred Halliday's book, The World at 2000, will be available from September onwards. And no doubt if you pick up one of these yellow forms, you will get a 20% discount even then, although Steve Kennedy might shoot me for saying that if he's listening. Well, it is a particular pleasure, as I said, he is listening, he's sitting in the front row, particular pleasure to be able to introduce my friend and departmental colleague, Fred Halliday. He doesn't need much after many of you have been here last week and heard the director's introduction. When I was thinking about this event, I realised both pleasure and horror, really, that we've been colleagues in the same department for about 17 years, which is a really terrible time. But it's gone very quickly, I think. I've enjoyed it anyway. Let's hope there are plenty more years in that collegial relationship. You know that Fred's, of course, intellectual range is enormous, and we heard last week a taste of all that. He has, I must say, been a really tremendous departmental colleague as well. He's not just well known for his activities as a public intellectual and events like this, taking the initiative, being able to speak on and write on a very wide range of subjects, and of course one of the few people who can lecture with authority on both Russian and American foreign policy. But he's also been an exceptionally good colleague in the things which don't get seen so much in the public eye in terms of doing the things that have to be done in a big and complex academic department. And it's been a pleasure to work alongside him. Now, today he's going to be giving this lecture called The Security and Conflict, The Futures of American Power, which is a move, if you like, from the talking about the structure of the system last week to talking about actors and agents, or particularly one actor, one agent, United States, American foreign policy. I think in terms of international relations in this country particularly, the United States is seriously neglected. American foreign policy even is seriously neglected, but in terms of the wider issues of the role of the United States in the world, the impact of American civil society on others, we get it indirectly in terms of the analysis of globalization, literatures on imperialism and so on, but in terms of focusing square on what the United States is and what it does and what it has done, what its options are, and even its bilateral relations with other major states in the world, there are relatively few people in this country who actually make that their central intellectual interest. And I think that's very much to be regretted. And indeed, one could argue that in the UK academic world as a whole, beyond international relations, the United States is also surprisingly understudied. And we might, perhaps, Fred might have some thoughts on why this has been and continues to be the case. But I'm sure that in the future we should try and do as much as we can to turn it round and to encourage people who want to do PhDs on the United States in departments of international relations and other kinds of departments as well. So, enough of me. It's a pleasure to be able to turn the microphone over to Fred, and we will, as before, have some time for questions at the end of his lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris, very much for those kind words and remarks about collegiality, to which I will try and live up in the future, if not always entirely in the past. It's a great pleasure to be able to speak this evening in the second of this series, which is, as we know, part of the LSE's Spanning the Century series, and also sponsored by Macmillan, the Foreign Policy Center. Let me begin by saying why, faced with the possibility of giving four lectures on the world of 2000, I've chosen to focus one on the United States. It's because I think that in any survey of the world today, the question of the USA, of how to analyze it internally, how to evaluate its international role, is absolutely central. And as Chris has said, it's something that is too often neglected at the academic level. If you're running a speaker's seminar in a university, if you're running a day school for activists and NGOs, you're more able to get a speaker on land reform in Nicaragua or sedentarization in Mongolia than somebody who can talk sensibly about the generation of foreign policy in the United States. Yet not only is the USA the dominant power in the world and likely to remain so in the foreseeable future, I have no great surprises on that regard, but the changes taking place within the USA shape the lives of all of us, not just the 4% of the world who live in the land of the free, as it were. And they also challenge, I think, what many social scientists and thinking people may regard as the proper way in which society would develop. To make a crude analogy, in the mid-19th century, Karl Marx analyzed British industrial society because he believed it set the pattern for the rest of the world. In a famous Latin tag, he said, De te fabula narrator. Now, of course, he was wrong. The rest of the world didn't, in fact, follow the British path exactly. But nevertheless, what happened in the most advanced society in the world at the time did affect others and merited careful study. And I think the same argument applies today to the USA. It is both a world power and a model. But how we evaluate America is also of vital importance to the whole discussion of world affairs. America is the object of more controversy, more denunciation than any other power in the contemporary world. And this, too, merits recognition and discussion. There are many aspects of American foreign policy with which I would disagree, but I think that an instinctive anti-American reflex, which is very widespread and is a common option on the left and on the right, often conceals more than it reveals. The number of colleagues I've met, even in this university, who think the American foreign policy is run by the military-industrial complex and the arms manufacturers, and that's all there is to it. And yet, views about America, pro and con, pervade discussion not just of U.S. policy, but of many other questions, not just changes in modern society and values and globalization, but also, very obviously and very important for what we study and discuss at LSE, the recent cases of humanitarian intervention. My own view is that whether you're discussing Kosovo or Bosnia or Timor or Kuwait, at least half of all the public discussion in Britain hasn't been about those places at all. In fact, it's taken very little notice of what's going on in those places. It's been really about what do you think about America. And that goes, too, for discussions of globalization, goes for the whole debate on the WTO, goes for the debate on GM foods, and much else besides. So as the world enters the 21st century, I would argue that this question of how you discuss America is extremely important. This is the country, as I say, with a population of 275 million people now, only 4% of the world total, yet which has emerged at the end of the Cold War and in the process of globalization as the dominant power. The defense budget of the United States, for example, at $300 billion, and it's not going to go down, is equal to that of the next six countries in the world combined. In terms of political and diplomatic influence, and as well as in terms of the multiple appeals of its lifestyle, it is unchallenged. America is where things are happening economically in a way that none of us can predict. What, for example, are the consequences of the declining role of energy in economic growth, which we have seen in recent years in America? But it's also the home, if not the sole protagonist, of the IT revolution. Indeed, at times it's difficult to distinguish between globalization in its many forms and Americanization. And this appeal is felt across the world. There are those who reject it. Let me quote recently from the not very strident, usually rather timid London newspaper, The Independent, which wrote in the following terms, "The dumb certitude, the contempt for the poor, the facile amiability, the ostentatious religiosity, the callous laws, the love of guns, the Hollywood sensibility, the all-consuming fetish for material success, the showy insubstantiability of its politics, the celebrity junk, the infantile literal-mindedness, and the faith withal in America's planetary moral superiority." That not the most extreme of voices you may hear. Yet there are those, and I think they are more, who put the opposite argument. Classic argument put by an American journalist himself, Thomas Friedman, in the best-selling book The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which is as near as you'll get now to a sort of statement of America's 21st century cultural hegemony. He said, "We Americans are the apostles of the fast world, the enemies of tradition, the prophets of the free market, and the high priests of high tech. We want enlargement of both our values and our Pizza Huts. We want the world to follow our lead and become democratic, capitalistic, with a website in every pot, a Pepsi on every lip, Microsoft Windows in every computer, and most of all, with everyone pumping their own gas." But this tone is not confined to Americans. The curious French philosopher Jean Baudrillard echoed this in his book on America. "Whatever happens," he said, "and whatever one thinks of the arrogance of the dollar or the multinationals, it is this culture which the world over fascinates those very people who suffer most at its hands, and it does so through the deep, insane conviction that it has made all their dreams come true." Every year in this very lecture hall, I ask the 100 or so MSc students the question, in your view, what percentage of the world's population would like a green card, would like to go and live in America? So what percentage of 6 billion people would actually, if they were able to do so, like to grow and live in America? Well, the answers vary from a low 40% to as high as 70% or up. Much of Latin America and Africa, it seems large quantities of China, much of the Middle East, much of Russia, to name but some. And I think that those who criticize America and criticize its way of life have to bear in mind the fact that it is this attraction which is among the most important aspects of America's power in the world today. Now, let me say a little bit about how I've come across this issue myself. If you've been brought up in the windier and more remote parts of these islands in the 1950s, a certain fascination for America is, I'm afraid, ingrained in one's psyche, and I make no confessions for that. In the 1970s, I used to go to the United States a lot. I had the curious experience of being the timeout correspondent at the Republican convention in Miami in 1972, when Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon were voted in for, as they thought, 4 more years. And I saw John Wayne, no less, give the keynote speech. Well, that obviously taught me, what happened in subsequent months taught me a bit about the surprises of American politics. But for the 10 years before I came to LSE, I was employed by an American think tank, a liberal think tank in Washington, the Institute for Policy Studies. And I used to visit Washington frequently to take part in discussions there and retain a long affection and fascination for that city and for its politics. When I hear all the denunciations of the United States, as one does from abroad, I always remember that very creative engagement with people who were themselves highly critical of many of the things the United States was doing, not least, of course, at that time over the Vietnam War. It is certainly the case that we hear from the USA today, in some voices to which I shall return, and from its more pliant allies abroad, a worldview that is arrogant and illiberal, and which will, if it is not checked, lead the world towards greater confrontations in the future. And in some ways, the USA is too easily indulged by its friends abroad. But on the other hand, I do think that much of the criticism of the United States that one hears abroad, whether from the left or from the right, is often intellectually shallow. It's very slipshod with the facts, as well as being, in many cases, irresponsible in its broader judgments of international politics. And that approach is itself often compounded by voices from within the United States. One of the predilections of the US liberal and left critics is, of course, their own predilection to conspiracy theory, if not to denying that external events play any role in the formation of US foreign policy. My own book on the Cold War, which was written about 20 years ago, was certainly a critique of certain right-wing views, but it was equally an engagement with those within the United States who argued that U.S. policy on weapons or on third world intervention or on the world economy was simply a product of domestic politics. And I think that the critics of American foreign policy from within too little engage with, in an active way, that which is happening outside, ultimately ending up, not always, but often in a policy of liberal abstention. I always remember the remark of Gore Vidal, who thought he was being smart. He said, "Why should I worry about Saddam Hussein?" He said, "He's no worse than the LAPD." Well, Saddam Hussein is worse than the LAPD, as any Kurd or Iraqi Shia will tell you, a lot worse. And it's precisely that issue which makes it essential for America to remain engaged. Well, in what I want to develop this evening, I want to look at, first of all, the debate within the USA on foreign policy as it is now developing, and to underline the degree to which we may be faced with a much more nationalistic and difficult America than we've been faced with in recent years. I then want to look at some of the limits on American power and assess what appear to be America's strengths and weaknesses in the international arena. And finally, I want to offer some broad guidelines for how the non-American world may relate to the American in the years ahead. If we get it right, I mean in the non-American world, everyone may be the beneficiary. If we get it wrong, everyone, including the inhabitants of the USA, may well be the losers. Well, the greatest mistake to make about the United States, apart from wishing that it would behave like the rest of us, which it's never going to do, is to treat its foreign policy as unitary. It's the diversity and the debate that most characterize America's approach to the outside world. And it is the continuity of those debates from the Founding Fathers through the debates in the 30s on isolationism, through the debates on the Cold War, which contributes to the present debate within the US. It's interesting to follow the debate in the current presidential campaign on foreign policy. There is a very lively debate for the first time in 20 years on arms control, not one that is going the way that liberals might wish to see, but it has led the various Republican candidates as well as Gore to speak out on these issues. Bush, of course, made a fool of himself in a famous quiz, which I'm not sure many of us could have answered with for we're getting all the questions right about world figures, but Gore recently quipped that Bush thinks that Alfresco Fettuccine is the Italian prime minister. And in this sense, foreign policy is becoming perhaps more central than it has been in some recent elections since the Cold War. The dividing lines today, which in many ways are inherited from earlier debates and with some appropriate shuffling of the arguments, are between what is broadly termed a multilateralist and a unilateralist approach. Some invoke earlier debates very directly. They say, for example, that Jefferson would have been suspicious of what the current world commitment, the international commitment, is doing to US liberties. And you hear this in liberal form in those who criticize America for having created a national security state because of its international commitments. Whereas I wonder whether every state doesn't have a national security element and whether this isn't a rather idealized image. There are those who invoke Jackson, who say that America should opt for a much clearer proclamation of its national interest, and we're certainly hearing much more about national interest in this campaign. There are the Wilsonians, who would espouse liberal engagement and the assumption of some enlightened burden of world leadership. Certainly, multilateralism suggests an engagement not only with the outside world in its state form, but with international institutions, with the UN, with NATO, with the WTO, with international law, while the unilateralists are more skeptical about these and would push America's interests first. A full isolationism is, most people would agree, not on the cards, as it might have been before World War II, for the simple reason that America's economic power is so bound up with the rest of the world that it would be folly, even on the most nationalistic of grounds, to withdraw. Let me say something about unilateralism and how it is coming out in the presidential campaign. In early February, three of the Republican candidates had a debate which began on foreign policy, but as it was chaired by Larry King, it soon degenerated into farce. All three candidates were in favor of the deployment of protective missiles under the National Military Defense, the NMD program. George Bush kicked off by saying that the USA should stop trying to cooperate with China. He said he would treat China not as a partner, as Clinton had done, and indeed as his father had done, but as a competitor in world affairs. And this, of course, also touches on a growing anti-Chinese sentiment on the right in America, which is related to issues of nuclear espionage and party funding. Alan Keyes wanted to tear up the 1972 ABM treaty, as do many right-wing members of Congress. John McCain focused on the issue of rolling back rogue states and how he would be more vigorous in that domain. A voice that is not now heard within the Republican Party, but certainly has wider influence than his electoral following would suggest, is that of Pat Buchanan, the commentator and presidential candidate for the Reform Party. Buchanan's view is that America should get all its troops out of Europe. All troops out of Bosnia with 1 year, all troops out of Europe within four, is his slogan. And his general view of American foreign policy is very simple. It's America first, second, and third. Buchanan has been critical of the multilateral commercial arrangements such as NAFTA and the WTO. He took part in the Seattle demonstrations. He said, "I didn't throw the brick through the Starbucks window, it was the guy next to me," was the way he put it. He certainly opposes U.S. involvement in Kosovo and has gone so far, without recantation, to question the wisdom of U.S. involvement in World War II. In Congress, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich summed up his outlook on foreign policy in equally clear terms. "Our primary goal in foreign policy," he said, "is very simple. It is our intention to survive no matter what the level of chaos on the rest of the planet." Note in the phrase about chaos elsewhere an echo of the isolationist view that the U.S. should not get embroiled in stupid wars elsewhere, particularly stupid wars involving Europeans. A person of influence who remains on the scene is, of course, Senator Jesse Helms, who's used his chairmanship of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee to hold up funding for the UN and to lead resistance to the U.S. ratification of the Comprehensive Desband Treaty last October, the most serious rejection by Congress of an international treaty since the 1920 vote on the League of Nations. Helms has also given his name to the most unilateralist of all congressional measures, the Helms-Burton Act of 1996, which not only pursues embargoes against Cuba, but also seeks to impose extraterritorial U.S. controls and punishment on foreign companies that continue to trade with Cuba. The unilateralist agenda is, however, much broader than this and is growing by the day. Resistance to environmental and trade agreements, the promotion of the system of national missile defense that would decouple European defense from that of the USA, and continued harassment of the UN and other international organizations. The tensions building up in the defense field in this election year with regard to NMD and with regard to what is now considered to be the center of any 21st century military strategy, so-called information superiority, mean that the risks for alliances with other countries and for the U.S. role in world security is very serious. But Congress is undoubtedly the place where this unilateralism is most clear. Gone are the days when U.S. congressmen and political candidates made it a point to travel, particularly to Europe, to prepare themselves for discussion and decision after elections. Majority Leader Richard Armey from Texas has been happy to state that he's no need to visit Europe because, quote, he's already been there once. Trent Lott, the Senate Republican leader, in many ways expresses this idea equally well. He boasts also that he doesn't visit foreign countries. Indeed, a third, or some would say a half, of members of the U.S. Congress don't even have passports. Lott has openly mocked at the foreign names of his opponents in terms that are, I have to say, redolent of racist contempt. Of Michel Camdessus, the head of the IMF, he said, well, he's French and a socialist, need I say more? And his mocking at the name of the former Egyptian Secretary General of the UN, Boutros-Ghali, is well known. But this is not the only voice to be heard in the United States, and there is also a strong alternative view in favor of multilateralism and engagement, and indeed for a much more vital American defense of universal values. I commend to you, not that it is the most representative, but as an interesting source for these things, one of the recent issues of the weekly The Nation, which I used to write for, in which Richard Falk and Kai Bird and Bob Borisage and other people who I've collaborated with in the past offer their view of where American foreign policy is going. But of course, the person who has sought to epitomize this multilateralism in recent years is our dear friend William Jefferson Clinton. Now, Clinton is in some ways obvious and in some ways not so obvious an imperfect leader. All politicians are. And some of his decisions speak of an opportunism and a lack of courage that merit criticism. A recent case in point is his equivocation on a World Bank proposal in favor of lowering tariffs on exports by the poorest third world countries to the USA. And we all, no doubt, have our list of his failures. But the full-scale indictment to which he's often treated by conservatives and irate liberals alike is, in my view, unsustainable, as is that by expatriate British writers who should know better, such as Christopher Hitchens in his book No One Left to Lie To. Hitchens, who once said to me, if you want to impress an American audience, he said, start speaking in Latin. Many presidents, and some who are candidates this year, would have done much less than Clinton or tried to do much less than Clinton. And in the person of his, no doubt in some ways, ineffectual secretaries of state, Warren Christopher and Madeleine Albright, he has sought to maintain a more consultative and active engagement with international institutions. He has certainly stalled on NMD, he's tried to push through NAFTA, he's tried to push through a certain liberal interpretation of the WTO and environmental policy, and he has argued against immense congressional and domestic opposition, and also opposition not only from Congress, but from his own much more isolationist national security advisor, Sandy Berger, has argued for a U.S. role in Bosnia and in Kosovo. He has also pursued against critics of left and right a critical engagement with the two largest and most precarious powers in the world, Russia and China. And what, I would like to know, is the alternative to doing that? Multilateralism also appeals not only to some of the interests, but to some of the traditions in American thought of America as an international leader and in a Wilsonian way, the promoter of certain liberal values. To say that it is inadequate, to say that it has sometimes been short-sighted, is not, in my view, sufficient to saying that the venture of Clintonian multilateralism has been a complete failure, or that the alternative, which is never quite spelt out, would be better. Let me now move on to the context of American power. To view the debate purely in its own terms of unilateralism versus multilateralism is to miss a broader context, and particularly to miss those changes which may be shaping American power. First and most obviously, the United States is changing within, as it always has done. The dominance of the old internationalist East Coast establishment, which sustained engagement through World War II and the Cold War, is over, and it will not return. American society is also changing with the rise of Latino and Asian immigration and a consequent shift of geographic influence and political and economic power from the East Coast to the South and the West. Europe and the political commitments associated with the European engagement are receding. I don't think it's possible to establish any direct one-to-one relationship between the changing composition of the USA and its foreign policy, with perhaps with the exception of Cuba, where the Cuban vote in Florida and New Jersey, and of course recently refracted through the Ellion case, or the Alien case as they call it in the US, has constituted a block to any development in relations with Havana. But there is a certain convergence, perhaps an elective and electoral affinity, between demographic change and resurgent post-Cold War unilateralism. A shift towards the Pacific and Latin American areas and away from Europe, the insistent populist rejection of international institutions, which draws on many old themes in America as well as new ones, a more angry note on trade and employment issues may meet the concerns of multiple constituencies. At the same time, interest in and knowledge about the outside world, never very high, has been declining if the coverage of international issues in the press and electronic media is anything to go by. I remember in the early 70s giving a series of talks in American cities, and one of the striking things coming from here was that you'd be giving these talks in churches, which is not a common experience this side of the Atlantic, and in union locals. And in Detroit, I'd given a talk about Middle East politics, and afterwards someone came up to me and he said, you know, Mr. Halliday said, if you live in Detroit, there's no way you can find out what's going on in the rest of the world. Because the local press doesn't tell you anything. In those days, there was no significant national television news. There wasn't even national public radio. And you could go down to the Greyhound bus station and buy the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times at three times the price in New York. But that was virtually the only way of finding out. Well, things have changed in some ways. But in other ways, the insulation of news coverage is as strong as ever. The broader reason is perfectly obvious. If you're the hegemon, you don't have to know what the outside world is doing. The former UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali, who was hounded out of office in a scandalous way, in this case by Clinton and Albright, put it very politely and compared the Americans to the Romans. You don't need diplomacy, he said, if you are so powerful. But the changes in American society are compounded by changes in the outside world and by the limits which changes in the outside world are imposing on it. And here, I would like to address what is the classical question in international relations, which is the question of the balance of power. In other words, where and when will a challenge to the United States come from outside that would force greater attention? This is perhaps the oldest of all international relations questions, and it implies that if any one power becomes too strong, others will form a coalition to offset it. Well, it's very hard to find traces of such a coalition in the world today, not least because much of the world seems to wish to bandwagon, to join in the American way of life and the American economy, rather than to upset it. Perhaps unfair to tell this story, but I like it, so I will, that a few years ago I had a very interesting commission from the BBC to interview American foreign policymakers on the Cold War and its aftermath. I had occasion to interview, in particular, in his office in Manhattan, Dr. Henry Kissinger. Now, Kissinger had recently published a book called Diplomacy, which not only defended his record on the Cold War, Nixon, Cambodia, and so on, all of which he defended in the interview with me, but also he defended the idea of the balance of power and argued that this was the central concept with which to understand international relations. This is what had done it for Napoleon, this is what had done it for Hitler, and this, in a way, with some variations because of nuclear weapons, had done it in the Cold War. So with his permission, I set him an exam question. I set him one of the questions I'd set our BSc Econ International Relations undergraduates a couple of years before. What, the question went, is the relevance of the concept balance of power to the post-Cold War world? Well, Dr. Kissinger did not really have an answer. He went as follows. He said, very difficult, very complicated. I would answer that there are various kinds of balance of power that have to be dealt with simultaneously, economic, political, maybe military. I would really now no longer say balance of power so much as equilibrium. It's more or less the same thing, but not exactly the same thing. I would add to it an equilibrium between ends and means. It's the unanswered question of our period, he said, for which America is very badly prepared. Well, I said to him politely that the answer he gave would at best have got a beta minus or, you know, a sort of 55 in the exam. But the point was, if he didn't have an answer, I don't think any of the rest of us do either. We simply cannot see a way in which the balance of power will return in the immediate foreseeable future. But if that is the case, there are other approaches which I think we can be somewhat more certain about. The Cold War ended, let it be remembered, with George Bush's call for a new world order, a form of Soviet-American cooperation that was, so Bush argued, evident in the campaign to evict Iraq from Kuwait in 1990 and 1991. I think there was more to be said of the new world order than subsequent derogation of it have suggested, insofar as in a range of other countries, I think of Namibia, I think of Cambodia, I think of Central America, the collaboration between the Soviet Union and the United States to resolve regional issues did bear some fruit. And if they didn't bear definitive fruit, it was because the local partners didn't want to pursue it that far. But the Russians did get out of Afghanistan. There was progress on the Arab-Israeli question. There were settlements in other parts of the world. But Bush was not rewarded by the U.S. electorate for his espousal of the New World Order. And of course, the other half of the New World Order disappeared with the collapse of the USSR in 1991, which brings us back to the U.S. as the single world power. But the problem is that even if the U.S. is the single world power, or the hyperpower, or the superpower, or the indispensable power, its power is limited. I don't want to comment on the longer-run question, for which I don't have a view, but I think one should avoid dogmatism, of whether America's power in the contemporary world economy, including its power in the internet world and in the cyber world, will in fact be consolidated or eroded. As a lay, very lay person who occasionally even suffers from cyber rage, my sense is that the United States' domination is assured for quite some time, that it is, to put it mildly, stitched up. But I may be wrong about this, and we can only wait and see. But let's look at three other areas of American power and look at the limits rather than the excesses of what America is capable of. First, there is the issue of diplomatic interventions in inter-ethnic conflicts. The United States has been actively, and in my view, largely responsibly involved in trying to promote negotiated solutions to communal and inter-ethnic conflicts around the world, in Ireland, in Palestine, in Nagorno-Karabakh, in Kashmir, in Ethiopia and Eritrea, and elsewhere. In Bosnia and Kosovo, the U.S. has intervened, perhaps too late, perhaps indecisively, to try and prevent further massacres and killings. And the ceasefires there, which only hold because of foreign troops, nevertheless do hold. It is true that no final full peaceful settlement has been reached in these areas, and that elsewhere, in many of the other cases, the diplomatic interventions of the U.S. and the Europeans have not borne fruit. We can see in the Horn of Africa the most serious interstate war currently brewing in the world between Ethiopia and Eritrea, where nobody's mediation, not the U.S., not the EU, not the OAU or anyone else, seems to produce a proper resolution. The conflict in Kosovo, centered on Mitrovica, involving both Serbian and Albanian nationalist gangsters, has a long way to go to find solution. Clinton tried on his visit to South Asia in March to persuade India and Pakistan to abandon their nuclear policies and to negotiate on Kashmir. Well, they listened politely and then made it clear that they paid no attention at all to what he'd said. But if this is the case, the responsibility, the fault, does not lie primarily with the United States, or indeed with any other outside powers, or with the multiple channels of mediation and effort which NGOs and other mediators have tried to use. The fault lies with the local politicians, those in and out of power, who have obstructed compromise, lied to international negotiators, in some cases arresting and even killing UN and other personnel, promoting hate against their neighbors and reneging on the spirit, if not the letter, of agreements. The US may be the dominant world power. It is not omnipotent. No external combination of powers would be. And that is the limit, the real limit, not hypocrisy, imperialism, or anything else of what the United States has been able to do in these interethnic conflicts. Second example of the limits in US power concerns one of the most pervasive and intractable and, in my view, insoluble problems in the contemporary world, and that is the problem of the narcotics trade. Drugs are today the second largest commodity traded in the world by value after oil. And the US is the largest importer and consumer of illegal narcotics, while it has tried since the late 1980s to inhibit the supply of cocoa and its refined form cocaine. As long ago as 1989, Congress passed the National Defense Authorization Act, which made the Department of Defense the single lead agency in the war on drugs, a task the Pentagon was initially reluctant, very reluctant, to take on, but which in the end, and with the demise of the Cold War, it saw it as attractive as becoming involved in. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in certain Latin American countries, in Peru, Colombia, and Mexico, in an attempt to wipe out production and processing and to interdict supplies of these drugs to the United States. Yet the policy has not succeeded. Whenever one area or means of transport is targeted, others take their place. The large cartels of a decade ago, Medellin and Cali, have now been replaced by a mass of smaller groups, the cartelitos. But the ineffectiveness of this campaign pales before two other problems. One is that the US policy is directed against the suppliers, against poor farmers who earn three times as much from producing drugs as they could conceivably could from any other crop. It is not directed so much against the consumer, but it is in the US that you have the demand for the soft and for the hard drugs. Drug users are, along with car users and those addicted to nicotine, a major domestic lobby, if an unseen one, numbering several millions indeed. So displacing the problem onto the suppliers is not a solution. On the other hand, US policy of drug interdiction tied to military, and in the case of Colombia, counterinsurgency activity, leads and leading to cases of extradition dispute, is widely seen as a new form of imperialist intervention. In Mexico, Colombia, and Peru, there is growing anger at the intervention and one-sided character of US narcotics policy. The drugs issue has been growing for two decades in the US and in Europe, and governments have failed and are failing to address it. They dither between supply interdiction and ineffective discussions of legalization. They just hope it won't go away, and if it's on the front cover of the Daily Mail in this country, they'll follow whatever the Daily Mail suggests. Policy experts and those involved in interdiction continue to tell us that they have solutions, that things are going in some way or another to get better. In this matter, I have to say, and having listened in some degree to different sides of the arguments, I greatly doubt if things in any way are going to get better. The limits, but also perhaps the confusions of the US power, are evident in a third respect, that of its policy towards what are termed rogue or pariah states. Now, the debate is often how to treat these states. How should we relate to pariah states? But I think it would be better to begin by questioning the terminology itself. I think the very category is spurious, denying as it does the legitimate national interests of the states involved, creating the image of a world ruled by a morally righteous global sheriff or groups of sheriffs, and also highly selective. The two countries which have done most to promote Islamic military terrorism in the world are Pakistan and the Saudi Arabia. Yet these are the two countries which are singularly exempt from criticism in this category. There's also, I have to say, an element of historical foreshortening here, as the causes of today's conflicts are too easily denied in US and Western discussion. Iran has certainly supported terrorist acts abroad and plays a thoroughly irresponsible role in the Arab-Israeli peace process. But these pale, in some ways, before what Western countries, including Britain, have done to that country, to Iran, in modern history. In the case of Britain, they invaded Iran twice, once in each of the world wars. They overthrew, together with the Americans, the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953. And in 1980, when Iran was invaded by Iraq, in a clear violation of the UN Charter, the Western powers blocked the UN Security Council from condemning Iraq and subsequently went on to support Iraq in its war effort against Iran. These are major rogue and pariah activities by any standards, far greater on any moral or international legal calculus than anything Iran has done to the outside world. It's in this regard that the policy of the Europeans towards Iran and towards other states is, in my view, preferable. European policy of engaging with Iran is far more creative and informed than it is the embargo on the oil and gas industries authorized by the US Congress through ILSA, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act. Policy towards Cuba is equally short-sighted. There has to be, and there will be, a process of democratization in Cuba, but is not one that is helped, but is rather hindered by the US embargo, which is itself a prisoner of the Cuban-American voting lobby and its very unilateralist allies in Congress. And here, indeed, we come to the very bogus character of the rogue and pariah categories. Neither Iran nor Cuba have invaded any other country, nor are they threatening the security of the United States. Indeed, it is the United States and Britain and other Western states who, as I say, backed Iraq in its criminal war against Iran, and it was the US which sank a third of the Iranian Navy in the concluding period of that war. These limits and others one could mention, domestic and international on US power, mean not only that there is no new world order, but that to an increasing degree, the world may not be subject to US political or strategic control. Balance of power is most certainly not a factor in the contemporary world, even as its proponents lengthen the time frame in which some rival power or power bloc, Russia, China, Europe, whatever, emerges to challenge US hegemony. What there is in the world, and this is the obverse of the story, is something that I mentioned last week at what I called, slightly facetiously perhaps, the highest stage of globalization, which is a growing paranoia and resentment to the USA, which takes issue not only with US military intervention as such, but also with the impact of US policies on a range of issues from information technology to human rights, and which sees a hegemonic, indeed imperialist intent whenever US actions or influence are held. A new world will not replicate the old in creating a power bloc to challenge Washington. But what we do see is the spread of this globalized resentment based on claims and issues, false or not so false, which threaten, I think, to create a more rancorous and uncontrollable world that US power, and indeed no diplomatic power, may be able to control. In that sense, if we're looking for a challenge to the contemporary international order, it will come in this form rather than the emergence of another conventionally defined rival bloc. Let me now come to this critique of American power, because faced with the dangers of US unilateralism and with the dominance of US policy and culture, and with undoubted inconsistencies in US policy itself, it's tempting to fall back on a denunciation of the US and all its works. And there is no shortage of such an attitude in the contemporary world. Some of this takes a left-wing form, denouncing US expansionism and imperialism and seeing today's policies as a continuation of undoubtedly illegal earlier actions in Latin America or of the war in Vietnam. But some is expressed in a right-wing version, perhaps from this side of the Atlantic, most evident in France, and a denunciation of the hyperpower of US strategic and economic dominance. In the Third World, anti-American sentiment takes the form of the attack on globalization and on US so-called cultural imperialism. And in many countries, there is, in various local forms, a diffuse phenomenon which sees the US as somehow engaged in a global conspiracy directed against their country. And like all paranoia, of course, it's their country, Serbia, China, wherever it is, which is some Russia, which is the special target, Mexico, which is the special target of this American conspiracy. We've seen quite a lot of this kind of argument in recent years. Kosovo, like Kuwait before it, occasioned much of this denunciation. Most of the critique of intervention paid, as I've said, almost no attention to what was going on in these countries themselves. I was recently in Kuwait, and when I came back, I got down from my shelves four or five of the books and readers on the Kuwait crisis, which I'd kept. There wasn't a single Kuwaiti voice in any of them, because it was irrelevant to the broader issue which was taking place, it seemed, within the Western hegemonic bloc. But beyond the particular details, there seems to be a deep, almost unconditional suspicion of the US in everything it does. Since the US was wrong, therefore, and was only interested in oil, which doesn't seem to me to be an entirely illegitimate concern, since many people drive motor cars, Kuwait had, it seems, no rights at all. It was, of course, also feudal, just as, in another idiom, the US has become fascist. Well, of course, Kuwait is no more feudal than the Americas fascist, or to use another idiom, the Soviet Union was capitalist. Since the intervention in Kosovo itself had been prearranged as part of a long-standing US attempt to impose itself on NATO on the Balkans, and since Serbia was standing out against this, what Serbia was doing was either innocent or invented. Now, in both the Kuwaiti and Serbian cases, incidents of attacks on civilians or of misleading statements by Western spokesmen, such as the rather unimpressive, underwhelming Mr. Jamie Shea, were taken as evidence of an underlying criminal intent and long-term strategy. And those who sought, with whatever arguments, to argue in balance in favor of intervention against clear violations of the UN Charter and of human rights were, of course, Tomahawk liberals and NATO apologists. Resort was also had here to the charge of double standards and to claims that if human rights had been relevant, then the US or NATO or Blair or Cook or whoever would have acted sooner. But all these arguments have a spurious element about them. Certainly there are double and imperfect standards, but that doesn't invalidate where legitimate actions are taken. No state acts for purely altruistic reasons, so saying that there was an element of self-interest involved doesn't really get you very far. As for retrospective conspiracy theories, which make out the whole thing was rigged up in advance, that America had been out to dissolve Yugoslavia for 20 years, that the Americans invited Saddam Hussein into Kuwait and all of this, these are, on closer inspection, not very substantial arguments. But of course, there's no shortage of such convenient theories on the right. A perhaps extreme version of it, but one that I think makes the point well, is a recently published French book by Alexandre Delvaille called Islamisme et États-Unis, Islamism in the United States, Une Alliance contre l'Europe, An Alliance Against Europe, which argues that Islamic fundamentalism and the USA are in fact in league to undermine the European state and European society. Europe faces an Islamo-Yankee offensive. McDonald's and Michael Jackson combined with jihad and Muslim immigration to sap European society and the virtue of European women, so we're told. The attack on Serbia is part of an attempt to create a Muslim state in Europe and strengthen the hold of Turkey over the Balkans. Iraq is attacked, but why? Because it had historically good relations with France. And the sanctions on Iran and Libya are, of course, fakes, designed to prevent European businesses from trading openly with them, with Iran and Libya, while US companies operating through dummy companies monopolize dealings with these states. So-called human rights policies are another form of subversion. Ultimately, we have to recognize, the author says, that America is a society created by an alliance of Puritan fanatics and the riffraff of Europe, those who ran away. And they are in league with the destructive and expansionist ethic of Islam. Now, demented as such ideas might appear to be, they reflect elements in or an undercurrent of right-wing anti-Americanism that is very widely diffused in Europe, which has its counterparts elsewhere, and which is far too rarely challenged in its own terms. Indeed, this kind of anti-American conspiracy theory is, like any such mindset, like astrology, for example, a very resilient ideology. It makes predictions, it can deal with anomalies, it can explain virtually everything. And if America were to do something good in the eyes of the critics, then it's always for the wrong reasons. 2020 retrospective vision, gross claims of historical continuity, a great exaggeration of American power, and a resort to apparently smart critiques, as well as a studied refusal to analyze the moral alternatives, seem to combine with a degree of cultural loathing. This, of course, also relates to the view of American society itself, and a view of American culture and lifestyle, which never more so than in the era of globalization has become the object of scrutiny, of admiration, and of denunciation. There is much in the United States which, to the skeptical observer, might appear to be open to criticism. The most important issue, which I won't dwell on here, of course, is the relatively diminished role of the state in assuming responsibilities towards the disadvantaged in society. But let us be clear that on this matter, as on others, the United States is a country of diverse views. There has been enormous debate, not least on the issue of Medicare, and those who tried to get it through Congress cannot be faulted for the attempt which they made in this regard. As for the role of the state in regulating the economy, this has, of course, been in retreat in many countries, not just in the United States. And while the percentage of the US economy our GDP that is accounted for by the state is not as high as in Sweden or Holland, it is still pretty high, about 38 or 39% compared to the 8 or 9% which it was in the time of Roosevelt. There are other aspects of US society which, to the even more sympathetic European observer, appear reprehensible: the license for private ownership of guns, the maintenance of the death penalty, on which America is singularly immune to foreign criticisms, the mass levels of incarceration, the levels of crime are all matters of justified criticism. Last year, Amnesty International quite properly launched a campaign on the violation of international humanitarian law by the US government, federal and state, with regard to incarceration, trials, and so forth. Much of US popular culture, particularly in the false diversity of media coverage, is not of the highest or most edifying quality. No doubt, large amounts of entertainment that are not particularly pleasant are produced in the United States. But this is not the whole story. US literature, US architecture, jazz, fashion, at its best, US film, can compete with the best of culture in any country in the world. US publishing, the US universities, not to mention its scientific establishments, are leaders in this field. When it comes to a matter to which we in LSE and in British universities are singularly sensitive, the generosity of the middle classes towards their former colleges and the generosity of alumni, there is no comparison between the generosity of Americans and the mean-spiritedness which pervades Europe. We hear much about the Americanization of the English language, less about how it has enriched it, and not least by mediating other tongues, Yiddish, Latin American, Caribbean influences. Language is always changing. It would be ridiculous to claim that it could not. When we come to the social character of the United States, I think this is even clearer. Let us take three issues. On the issue of race, there is no comparison whatsoever, despite the continued and appalling failure of the United States to treat its Afro-American population properly. There is no comparison between the multiracial openness of the United States and the record of Europe and indeed Japan or Russia or any other country on this matter. The United States is streets ahead. When it comes to gender relations, or all the problems in the United States, again, it is the US which has set the lead in recent decades on addressing this question, both at the legal level and the political level, as well as at the level of a lifestyle. People say the United States is an imperialistic and militaristic country. Militaristic compared to whom? What do you mean by militarism? We mean by militarism a society in which the military have high social status, or one in which the country is singularly aggressive abroad. I would argue that the record of the 20th century will show that compared to any other major country in the world, the United States is less militaristic, not more. Compared to the British, the French, went trampling around the world on dozens of other countries. The Russians, look what they're doing in Chechnya. Let us not mention the Germans, the Italians, the Japanese, what they got up to in recent decades. Even the Spanish and the Portuguese ruling their colonies in the way that they did. And at the same time, the role of the military in American society, while financially important, the American military have a singularly low social status compared to the status which they have in a country like this. So on all of those issues, it seems to me that the critique is one-sided and fails to take into account the actual situation in the USA. Let me conclude with a few general points and a plea for some kind of critical engagement, and following on from what Chris Hill said, some kind of informed engagement. I began by arguing that the future of America, domestically and internationally, is one that concerns us all, the 4% who live in the USA and the other 96% who do not. The strengths of this society are evident, and never more so now, even as there is much that threatens it from within and without. They've had 9 years of sustained growth. Unemployment is the lowest in 30 years. The crime rate has fallen for the eighth successive year. The budget deficit has disappeared. Yet from within, we see a range of social problems, a degraded popular culture, falling electoral participation, and many other issues, which may in the longer run threaten the stability of that country. In the euphoria of the IT boom, it's worth recalling earlier crashes and the in some ways frail or bubble-like element in the current economic climate, particularly in stock market evaluations of e-com companies, may threaten instability in the future. In the field of what remains a central element of political life, leadership, and the moral intellectual requirements of that, America has, as it were, been underachieving. Internationally, too, there may be no rivals and no threats, but as I've argued, US domination and the reflexes and tone of unilateralism, which are probably going to get more are promoting this global resentment that is as unhealthy for those who fall prey to it as it is ominous for the USA itself. But let me just conclude by stressing four broad guidelines about how I think one could sustain such a critical engagement from without. First of all, there is knowledge of that country itself, something that is, as I've argued, remarkably weak in academic press and public contexts. A few years ago, I was invited to speak in Wake University in North Carolina. Now, North Carolina is about the size of England, has a population of 6.5 million. So I went to the library to get out some books on North Carolina. There were 4 or 5 of them, but no one had ever taken any of them out before. It was an interesting indication. In the press, in public debate, let alone in the conspiracy theories of left and right, this, I think, possibility and indeed obligation to study the country seems rather weak. There can be no informed, critical, engaged relationship with the USA from outside without trying to sustain and update a knowledge of what is happening inside the USA. And of course, the best way of all for those who can is to go there. Secondly, there is a need growing with every decade to engage with the lifestyle and culture of America, what Thomas Friedman sings the praises of in The Lexus and the Olive Tree, but to separate out that which is desirable from that which is not, and to discriminate between different strands and values in American politics and culture. And this pertains, of course, above all to the twin engines of contemporary, if impermanent, success, the market and the microchip. For some, these have provided the answer to the problems of modern and economic social change. For others, they reproduce and intensify inequality and a neglect of public goods and of public responsibilities and indeed of sequential consciousness, which are at the heart of a stable, just society. We can't know what the effects of these are for the US or anywhere else, but they merit careful study. And they remind us of a remark, or they remind me of a remark of Bertolt Brecht's, who once said, it is not communism which is radical, it is capitalism. Radikal ist der Kommunismus nicht, radikal ist der Kapitalismus, he said. And never was this truer than in the contemporary IT boom. American power also provides an index to the third indication of the third of the pillars of a response or critical engagement with it. At the moment, it is within limits a predominant power, and even under Clinton and under any foreseeable successor, this will remain so. And America will, in this context, pursue its own interests with its allies if it can, against them, or independent of them if it cannot. We see this in the increasing and possibly terminal debates over NATO, over NMD, over the American disparagement, which is much greater in private than it is in public, of the Anglo-French attempt to get an independent defense force going, in the debates on the WTO, in the administration of the World Wide Web. Let me repeat what I said last week, that the key issue for the WTO is not, with all respect, what the protesters on the street achieve, it's whether the Americans and the Europeans will be able, through the WTO, in a constitutional and negotiated way to resolve their disputes. It would be desirable to see a reduction in the arrogance of American power. I would like to see the back of Senator Jesse Helms, as we've seen the back of Senator Alphonse D'Amato. I would like to see a Congress that listened to the rest of the world and made it its business to find out. I would like to see a US media, printed and electronic, which paid sufficient attention to the outside world. I'd like to see a US film industry that did not seek to trample on the creations of other cultures and studios. I'd like to see a US email regime in which the US too had its own addressing suffix and not just the rest of us. But all of that having been said, the reality of American power and the tendencies in it to its proper use but also to its abuse will remain with us, and it's in that context that we have to sustain the debate. I would also like to see a more balanced discussion of what is the most visceral issue in US international relations in recent years and in the attitude of outsiders to, which is, of course, Vietnam. The United States lost 58,000 men in Vietnam, and nobody who visits, as I have done on more than one occasion, the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, which is a very dignified black slab of marble moving into the ground, can fail to be moved by this, especially if they are conscious, as someone of my age is, that those who died in that war were the same age as I was, but did not live to see the years which followed. But I think we also need to hear not just about what Vietnam did to America, but a bit more about what America did to Vietnam. A little bit less about the American tragedy or the quagmire, as if it was no one's fault, and a bit more about the 3.8 million Vietnamese who died, the devastation of the economy and the ecology, and much else. I would suggest that we start reading about Vietnam by reading the great Vietnamese novel, The Sorrow of War, by Bao Ninh, a very measured and deep study of the devastation of war on both sides, rather than the one-sided debate which has prevailed up to now. But all of this reflects, of course, the interests and culture of one approach, and it is something we have to take in large measure as a given. Finally, and in the context of these lectures on the world at 2000, and looking forward to what values and institutions we may have to improve the world, let me return to an issue which I think underlines this whole debate, as it has done since the 18th century, and which pertains to both Olive Tree and Lexis, which is that of political and ethical values. The political language and values of America were derived from Europe, but they have their own particular history and residence. How else to understand the debate, the terror of taxation, or the debate on capital punishment or gun control? But this language is one which remains shared with Europe and now with the rest of the world, which has been incorporated sometimes by subjugation, sometimes by imitation into the global system. The values of democracy, independence, pluralism, economic prosperity, and most significantly rights in their political and social dimensions are ones that America has at its best espoused, even as they are differentially interpreted the world over. It's a point I often annoy, not just left-wing critics of America from outside by making, but indeed even many critical Americans by saying, is if you look at the world since 1945, particularly at Western Europe, and ask the question, where have most of the radical ideas come from? They have not come from Gosplan or the Cultural Revolution or the Long March or anywhere else. They have come from the United States. If you think of the Civil Rights Movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the gay liberation movement, Margaret Thatcher was a great one for imitating America, but she certainly wouldn't have imitated freedom of information if she could have avoided it. And most, not all, but most of the radical ideas that have affected Western Europe have come, in fact, from the USA, which is the USA, as I say, at its best. It's often forgotten that May the 1st, the International Day of the Workers, is derived from the Haymarket. 89, March the 8th, International Women's Day, is also an American date, and so forth. So on the basis of that tradition, it seems to me the possibilities of a dialogue continue. And I would argue that the United States, for all its imperialism and its inconsistencies, has played and can again play an important part in defining, redefining, and promoting these values. The debate is not between America and the outside world, but it's as much as anything within America, as this issue of the nation and as the Gore-Bush debates exchanges indicate, and about how different interpretations of what are global issues of peace, of prosperity, can be discussed, and of how others may participate in that debate. The world of the 21st century cannot be and will not be fashioned without America, nor should it be fashioned on America's unilateralist terms, especially when these are defined in a selective and hegemonic manner. That, I think, is the debate that now the world now faces. It may be that faced with the predominant or indispensable power, which the US clearly is, neither rejection nor adulation provide the best answer. Thank you.
So may I ask you to put up your hand if you want to ask a question, and when you do so, perhaps you'd be kind enough to say who you are, and if you're from outside the LSE, where you're from, please. Sir.
Said that the U.S. is not so militarized as other powers. However, look at this. The other two regimes thinking you're the founding member, so I don't understand why you say that they are not so militarized. I want to ask you that question.
You know, keep it brief, because that's a pretty big question.
Yeah. Very brief. The U.S. is now the country that rules Latin America. If you're in any Latin American country and you want to ask what the government has to do, they ask to the U.S. ambassador. And even the name of America, it's a way of oppressing or expropriating our name. I'm Latin American. I'm also an American. It's like saying that Germany is Europe, or Asia is China, or Africa is Egypt. So even the fact that they are today that are only 20 or 30% of the territory and the population of America claim to be the Americans, and it's also explaining how this power tries to believe that the rest of the continent is part of them.
Well, thanks, Isaac, for formulations that I want to happy to address. First of all, I made clear on more than one occasion in this lecture that I think the United States' record in Latin America has been and remains, particularly with regard to Cuba, reprehensible. And this, I have no disagreement with you on this. Secondly, the term militarized or militarization or militaristic has many meanings, and one ought to be clear what the terms are. And I defined it in two ways. I'm quite happy for people to use other indices, but the two that I mentioned was one is the status of the military in society. You think of a society where the military are of high status, classically Prussia or somewhere like that, or Japan. And the fact is the United States, the military in the 20th century, have been much, much lower status than in any other major developed country. On the kind of, would you like your daughter to marry one? Do you go into it? And all the rest of it. If anything, it's been a mechanism for social mobility. It has not been a high status activity in a high status position in society, and I'd stick to that. People may disagree, in which case I'm happy to yield. As for whether the United States is more belligerent than other countries, I would doubt it. Compared to the British and the French in the 20th century with their empires, compared, as I said, to the Germans, the Japanese, to the Italians, I wonder whether the United States has not started any major world wars. In fact, it's actually, if anything, the British complain they came in far too late. The strong populist sentiment in the United States is against involvement in external wars. And if you, I'm not saying that it is a militarist. What I'm saying is, who are the Brits, the French, the Japanese, the Germans, or Russians, or anyone else to go around accusing America of being militaristic and deriving sort of moral superiority from so saying? When you come to the question of the United States' military role, first of all, don't exaggerate. The United States did not overthrow the popular unity government in Chile. The Chilean military and middle classes overthrew them. And it's very commonly said, we have all this evidence of the CIA involvement. Maybe there was. But I don't believe that Pinochet and the readers of El Mercurio required the CIA or anybody else to tell them to do what they did for a minute. And one sees it in the cases of other coups, or cases where the Russians were involved. People always blame the external powers. Well, what about the local repressive forces themselves who had their own reason for doing it? Guatemala is a much clearer case, as is, of course, Iran in 1953. As for the long list you gave, some of the interventions of the United States are ones which I would disagree with, but some, like its role in the Second World War, or its role in Bosnia or Kosovo, I would think are defensible. And in that sense, you seem to me to have slipped into the mistake of saying that everything the United States has done is wrong, whatever it is. And I think one has to be more discriminating. And maybe they can do better. Yeah, I think you put your finger on it. I think their response will be ambivalent. On the one hand, having complained for years, particularly after the end of the Cold War, that the Europeans don't pull their weight, And anyway, there are shambles, they're all over the place. If Europe then proceeds to try and pull its weight, they should be pleased at this and welcome greater autonomy. But of course, this would, if this means challenging US control of NATO or US hegemony in NATO, they're not going to like it. Secondly, we come to the ways in which at each stage of the arms race or the development of weapons since the Second World War, American superiority in certain fields of weaponry precludes sharing or equality even within an alliance. And today, this is evidently the case, not just to do with overall budgetary expenditures, which, as I say, are larger than all the six nearest competitors put together, or six other states put together, but it relates in particular to the two issues which are of visceral importance today, the issue of missile defense, of interceptors, which will hit, or allegedly hit, incoming missiles, which the United States is only going to have for itself. And secondly, and perhaps even more importantly, because this was absolutely central in even campaigns like Bosnia or Kosovo or Kuwait, the whole issue of information superiority. In other words, are they going to share? The Europeans can't mount. I mean, the key to this invulnerable military strategy they've got and to the revolution in military affairs is knowing where the enemy forces are and the enemy not knowing where you are. That's in one sentence what it is. And that's why they've been able to conduct these campaigns with minimal casualties. But what they're saying is there's no way the Europeans could fight such a campaign, whatever Blair and Chirac get up to in St. Malo, without comparable intelligence and concealment mechanisms. In other words, without information superiority. And they could only do that with the United States. So on that issue, I think we're going to find the unilateralists going both ways. But ultimately, I think the days of what was an unnatural American commitment to Europe, which began with, in 1917 or, if you like, in 1941, are coming to an end. And I'm not at all confident we'll see, you know, the survival of NATO for 5 or 10 or 15 years. Having said that, the tough American line is, look, this European thing is a bit of a joke. There's no way that Blair and Chirac are going to run for election by raising defense expenditures in their own countries and raising the taxation. They're a long way, it's a political gesture, not more. They're a long way from making it a reality, so we can sit back and relax. And I defer to my colleague, Professor Hill, on this matter, since he knows much more about this than I do. Well, there's two different meanings, as I understand it, to the phrase after hegemony. One is the sense in which Keohane used it in the book of that name, where he implied that you needed a hegemonic power to set up an international trading system and an international financial system, but once it was set up, you didn't need a hegemon anymore to be the locomotive, the regulator, the whatever it was. So in other words, the world economy could work without a hegemon, it could be after a hegemon, once the thing was up and running. The second meaning is the declinist argument, that American power is declining. Well, on the first point, and in fact on both points, our late colleague Susan Strange wrote very robust rebuttals with which I am in broad agreement. Robert Keohane is a very distinguished international theorist, and far be it for me to criticize him in general, but this book is really has not stood the test of time. Why? Because he took, of all issues, the International Energy Agency, and what he said was that while the U.S. hegemony may have been needed to control the oil market and guarantee oil price, the reduction of oil prices in the 70s and combat OPEC, now that we have the International Energy Agency, there is a multilateral liberal institution not dependent on states which can regulate world oil prices and world oil supplies and production. Well, I'm afraid what's happened since is states have remained as central to the regulation of the world oil market as they ever did. Only recently we had this extraordinary situation in which OPEC got itself together for the first time in 25 years and raised the price of oil. Why? Because states collaborated with each other. And then the US said, we can't allow this. And Bill Richardson went around the Middle East. I was in the Persian Gulf and he showed up once and told them, you've got to lower the price of oil by $6. And if you don't, we're not going to defend you against Iraq. Very simple message. There was this extraordinary, Susan would have laughed if she'd seen it. There was this extraordinary meeting of the OPEC, whatever it's called, the Supreme Committee of OPEC.
And in the middle of it, Richardson rings up two of the delegates on their mobiles while they're in the meeting, the Venezuelan and the Gattari, and he says, you guys had better lower the price of oil or else, and puts down the phone. And of course, everybody else in the room could see this happening. So please don't tell us that we're after we're in a post-hegemonic world in the first sense. And on the other side, how does OPEC? OPEC is not a supranational organization, is not an NGO, is not a liberal. It's a group of states who are running a cartel, and when they see an opportunity, they stick up the price, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but it's certainly not post anything. The declinist issue, all of us have got things wrong in our time, but if you look back on the literature on American decline in the 80s, part of it, don't laugh, was that the Soviets are overtaking us in missile, MIRVing and accuracy and submarines, and they've got, all of which looks ridiculous now. Some of it was to do with the rise of other industrial and commercial powers with superior productivity and superior labor discipline like the Japanese or the Europeans. When I was working in Washington, you couldn't go into Kramer's bookstore without seeing five books on the coming Japanese threat to America. And where is this stuff now? It's a joke. Not only have the Japanese gone into prolonged stagnation, which the Japanese state has been unable, our private industry been able to stop, but the U.S. productivity has increased enormously in the last 10 years. So that all the declinist arguments that operated have been disproved, if anything can be disproved in social science. And then thirdly, there was a particular version of all this, which I noted on the liberal left American literature, at the end of the Cold War, amidst the discussion of why did the Soviet Union collapse, they'd say, well, we also paid a terrible price for the Cold War. And, Jesus, we're hurting too in the U.S. They've got problems in Russia, but, we got problems too. That's a ridiculous argument. America won the Cold War, whether you like it or not. And actually, America did quite well out of the Cold War in lots of ways I could go into. So the idea that somehow the decline was accelerated through overextension, the Paul Kennedy argument, simplified, I hasten to add, because his argument's very sophisticated, is simply invalid. So in both those senses of after-hegemony, it ain't happened. And, the WTO is not a key or heinous post-hegemonic organization. It's WTO rests on the European Union and the US sorting out their problems or not, with agreement with others. I think it's no secret that the special relationship looks very different from this side of the Atlantic to the other. And America has special relationships with about 20 countries, of whom Great Britain is one. There is certainly a section of the American elite which retains this kind of Anglophilic, we love Britain, Churchill, all the rest of it, attitude. And this is replicated in some ways in this country. What is interesting is in this country that the way to maintain the alliance with the United States is never to talk about it. It's like class. You don't talk about it. And if you don't talk about it, it won't be. There's never been a serious debate in the House of Commons, I'm aware, about the overall nature of Britain's relations with America, because it's better not to talk about it. The Britain has not had an independent nuclear deterrent since the Nassau Agreement of 1962, but nobody says that. And left and right in this country have participated in that. And I think still you'll find in Whitehall and in think tanks around London, some of them not far from here, they may in private be very critical of what the Americans are up to and are going to do, because I think they are going to do it on NMD, but they won't say so. In fact, one of the interesting, and it bears out what Chris Hill was saying at the beginning, in trying to research this lecture, I went around trying, where can I find a good informed article on U.S. unilateralism, either in The Economist, which is the house journal of the mid-Atlantic power elite, if you like, or in the Tribune or in the Financial Times or anywhere else. I couldn't find one. Then I emailed friends in the States who work in the policy institute I used to work in, others. They couldn't find one either. So one found a good article on U.S. unilateralism, meaning Clinton bailing out the South Koreans when the Europeans wouldn't do anything, and that was obviously a liberal unilateralism, so it wasn't what I was looking for. But it's remarkable how little these things are discussed, but as a way of not doing it. I mean, I make that as a general point. Will it continue? No, inevitably the boundaries are getting less. I mean, Trent Lott is not going to start speaking at Chatham House or going to English-speaking union dinners. And while there will be some sentimental links and military links, and while the British, more because of their reserve about Europe than anything else, will continue to sustain this, I think we'll be into much more choppy waters. And I think that if Bush is elected, he's not going to care that much about Britain. Why should he? I could be wrong. Sorry?
Yeah. You mentioned the resentment that the world against the U.S. and that this is the actual thing that's going to challenge the U.S. versus the old.
Yes.
So can you just elaborate on that a little bit more? What's the form of that challenge and how the U.S. can do that?
Well, I don't know. But I mean, if we attach any value, as I think we should, and as some social scientists have said for many years, it's not a recent discovery, that values, perceptions, discourse, myths play a role in politics and in the press and in people's attitudes, then I think we should pay attention to paranoia in general as a feature of international relations. I mean, the British paranoia about Brussels is another striking example. They want to abolish warm beer and, you know, the monarchy and all that. But also, what are they going to regulate next, my milkman said to me last week. But also to what is the most pervasive aspect of this, it overlapping with globalization. But globalization is in large measure seen as an American policy, and as a policy, first of all, which it ain't, but as a policy, and secondly, as a conspiracy designed to undermine country. I mean, that is how it is seen in much of the world, whether it's in Russia or in China or the Middle East, and I suspect elsewhere. And what will the consequence of that be? I think it would be, in very practical terms, first of all, it would be difficult for states where these sentiments are strong to conduct normal relations with the United States or as collaborative relations as they would wish. I mean, why can Iran not normalize its relations with the United States on the Iranian side? Because of this. Basically, the spiritual leader of the country says globalization is a cultural American imperialist conspiracy, and that's it. But I mean, in more moderate terms, that's quite widespread. Secondly, it will make negotiation on a range of economic and social issues, free trade, migration, labor codes, gender rights, all of these things much more difficult. I mean, you know, I was in the Kuwaiti parliament when they voted against votes for women recently. And one of the main arguments used is, well, the American ambassador's in favor of votes for women. So, you know, and given what I said this evening, you can imagine what I thought of that. I mean, these are anecdotes, but I think we can multiply them for every country. So I think it will affect foreign policy, security policy, it will affect trading policy, it will affect cultural policy. And it will affect also what you read in the press. And all I'm arguing for here is a more informed, measured discussion, and not to take either the sort of myths of hegemony or the counter myths at face value. And one place to start is in universities and studying it.
To thank Fred again very much for treating us to a special occasion, a special lecture. I think he's shown that although sometimes we write about the United States or indeed Germany in terms of whether they will ever be an ordinary country, the kind of thing perhaps that Henry Kissinger was thinking about when he often said that the United States needs to think more in terms of its national interests, less in terms of this exceptionalism which gets in the way of diplomacy. I think he's actually shown us that whether we like it or not, or the United States likes it or not, it is an extraordinary country, but one that we have to come to terms with, and they have to come to terms with. And I think the highest compliment I can pay Fred is that he has made sure that we don't have any kind of group think on these issues. He's left us with some uncomfortable thoughts so that we understand the contradictions and the complexities involved in coming to terms with this extraordinary country. Thank you very much, indeed.